Final case on the court's oral argument calendar this morning is Amwenga versus Rasugo and New Gen Contractors, case number A240557. We are ready for oral arguments. Each side will have 15 minutes for primary argument. Appellant's counsel will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. With that, we are prepared to hear from counsel for appellant. Would you take the podium? Introduce yourself for the record and then begin your argument.
Good morning and may it please the court. My name is Ford Amwara and I represent the appellant New Gen Contractors in this matter.
You may proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. We are here today because the district court has asked us to refund in full the amount of money that the homeowner paid to have work done at his home. No money was given to us, but substantial work was done at the home. So we have raised 4 issues on appeal. First of all, Minnesota law requires that contracts for home construction be in writing. This contract was not in writing, and we are saying it should not be enforceable under Minnesota law. Secondly,
Marshall, could you start the clock, please? Thank you.
Sorry
for the interruption. Go ahead.
That's okay. Secondly, the evidence that's on record does not support a finding of an oral contract. And we are going to show in this argument that the elements of a contract were not met. And then the third argument you're making is that the mediated settlement agreement between the parties, this is the parties, the efforts by Mr. Wallace Rasugu, who was the contractor in this case, and Mr. Amwenga, who is the homeowner, that the settlement efforts that they made themselves should be recognized by the court and should not just be ignored. And then the fourth argument we're making is that the actual damages that the homeowner alleged to have suffered should be pleaded and proved if, in fact, the court finds that there was a contract, because there was no reason why the actual damages were not required to be pleaded and proved, particularly because there was substantial work that was actually done on the home by Mr. Wallace Rasugu. So on the statutory scheme, there is a statutory scheme in Minnesota that covers exactly the circumstances that prevailed in this case. Minnesota statute section 326B.809 requires that contracts be in writing. But it is not just that statute alone that we are asking the court to look at. There are other provisions in that entire statutory scheme that covers home construction contracts. In fact, if I may, there is a kind of infrastructure for dealing with the issues that prevailed here, because the Department of Labor and Industry, through the commissioner, has sweeping powers under 326B.082 to enforce that statutory scheme. And 326B.84 defines conduct that can be sanctionable. So if in fact the plaintiff wanted redress for what he claims is basically misconduct on the part of the licensee here, then he could have started at the Department of Labor and Industry. Because under section 326B.84, entering into oral agreements by a contractor is basically misconduct, and that could be sanctioned by the Department of Labor and Industry. And the plaintiff did actually go to the Department of Labor and Industry and claim that work had not been done at his home. And when he did that, the first question he was asked by the Department of Labor and Industry is, can you give us a copy of the contract, or can you tell us evidence or proof that you had a contract with this licensee? And that is where it ended. It is because the plaintiff did not want that entire process that is covered by the statutory scheme, which is investigation, including even powers to go into the plaintiff's property and try to find out exactly what was done. The plaintiff wanted to circumvent all that, and that is why the plaintiff first went to the conciliation court.
But isn't your statutory argument missing a provision in 326B that indicates that the remedy for not having a written contract or specifically says that you can't seek to enforce an oral contract. So, I mean, I understand that it says written contract required and that your counterpart's argument is that applies to the licensee and not to the customer. But it would seem to me like your argument would be stronger if there was a provision in the statute that actually said if there is no written contract, the customer can't sue to try to enforce an oral contract or something along the lines of a clearly stated statute of frauds under this context specifically. What's your response to that?
No, I acknowledge that. But my response to that is that there is a reason why for almost 15 or more than 15 years that this statutory scheme has existed, we do not see cases talking about oral contracts. Why we do not see them in our court process. Because these cases actually, they end up at the Department of Labor and Industry, and I'm talking about home construction agreements. If we do a scan of the case law and the jurisprudence, we don't have a lot of cases that talk about oral home construction agreements. And the reason is because these types of claims, if there's a claim that a licensee or a contractor engaged in an oral home construction contract, that claim ends up at the Department of Labor and Industry. And the Department of Labor and Industry would do an investigation and make a determination. And then the court comes in to review the decisions of the commissioner. And that process ensures that there's a stopping of floodgates, if I could say. Because you can imagine how many kinds of disputes exist between homeowners and contractors. People who can claim that their work was not done on time, that their work was not done within the scope they wanted, that their work was not done within the
argument,
budget.
The Department of Labor and Industry argument, is this in your brief? That's because I'm understanding you to argue that's the exclusive remedy if you have an oral contract, is that you have to go to the DLI and seek relief through the DLI, and you can't come to court because of 326B.809? Is that what you're arguing?
I'm arguing that that's what the court should decide, because there's no cases on this point. There's no cases on this point.
The question is that an argument you made in the district court?
In the district court, we argued on the statute. We said that the statute was not met and that this case should not be decided as an oral contract, because the law requires the contracts to be in writing. So our argument there was that the law was clear. The letter of the law requires a written agreement. And in trying to elaborate that argument is where we are saying that the entire statutory scheme requires deference to the Department of Labor and Industry. And we have referred to the Department of Labor and Industry.
Why can't you do both? Why can't you bring a complaint to the Department of Labor and Industry and sue for breach of contract?
Yes, it is possible for somebody to do that, but if the court allows that process, if the court allows people to come to the court and claim essentially the same things that the entire statutory scheme has decided should be decided in a certain way, then we end up in the situation where we are today. We have this one case.
That's fine. I mean, if a doctor commits malpractice, you can sue him or her for malpractice, and you can also bring a complaint before the medical board and try to get his or her license revoked. You can do both. Why can't you do both here? Why can't he sue your client for a breach of contract and then try to get NewGen's license revoked? I mean, it seems like both are not mutually exclusive. Why are they mutually exclusive?
Yes, Jan, I agree that that could be done. But what we are arguing is that if that is done, then the court should look at that issue in a deferential standard. Because the court does not do the investigations, the subpoena, or any kind of process that's required by the statute. If the court has a complaint, for example, that NewGen engaged in misconduct, which is what it is, it's not just a contract claim, it's a misconduct allegation, because under the statute, entering into an oral home construction agreement is a violation of the law. And section 326B.84 lists that as a ground of sanctions. So if they are claiming that we did this misdemeanor, then the court will not have that capacity and that ability to go through the whole process of determining whether, in fact, a misconduct occurred. The court will simply look at the questions, like what was done here, as to whether there was a discussion between two people and make a determination. But if it was...
At least a suggestion in your addendum at A36, you included it looks like an email from Charlie Durenberger of the Department of Labor and Industry that suggests that the DLI was waiting for the litigation to be final before taking action, which I think, to Judge Connolly's point, would suggest that it isn't unusual to have a dual process of licensing action or administrative action at the same time as there's a dispute in court, whether that be on an oral contract or other claims. Isn't that the suggestion from that?
Your Honor, first, it is unusual because there are not many cases that the courts have decided on the issue of oral agreements, oral home construction agreements. The empirical evidence shows us that this doesn't come into the court most often. But it could, in theory, come. Just like the court has stated, a case can be brought for malpractice in court, and it can be brought for malpractice before the doctor's board. But if the court is looking at that kind of process, I think the court will be very well informed by the type of process that has been done by the doctor's licensing board, because they have the capacity to license, and they do license. They have the capacity to investigate. They do investigate, and they make a determination. And furthermore, in this case, if the Department of Labor and Industry makes a determination that the homeowner is not happy with, the homeowner can seek court review. So court review is not foreclosed at all, either at the beginning or at the end. It's not a jurisdictional argument. We are not saying that the court had no jurisdiction. We are just saying that the court used a process that deprived the court of the benefit of the evidentiary capacity that the Department of Labor and Industry has. Because if the Department of Labor and Industry had looked at this case, it could have investigated it. It could have determined the circumstances under which that money was given. Because check cashing, for example, is one of the misconducts listed under that statute. If a contractor improperly cashes a check, that is part of the misconduct. So the court could have looked at that issue, because the check was cashed in this case by Mr. Wallace Rasugu and money deposited to him personally, and none of the money was given to us. The other argument that we would like to make, Your Honor, before my time gets finished, is that there was a mediated settlement agreement that the parties entered into in this case. Because the court's decision that the mediated settlement agreement changed nothing ignores the effort that Mr. Wallace Rasugu and the homeowner made to try and resolve their dispute. And that effort started in July of 2018, and it went through several processes, including a court proceeding, and finally a community mediation effort that was initiated by the plaintiff. And at the end of that community mediation effort, both parties, both Mr. Wallace Rasugu and Mr. Mwenga, agreed that they signed a written agreement to resolve their dispute. But the court refused to look into the circumstances of that written agreement or even what was signed.
But
the court dismissed it.
The written agreement no longer existed. It wasn't presented at trial, right?
There was no copy of that written agreement presented at trial. It was the parties testified to it, which is actually more than the July 2018 oral agreement that the plaintiff is claiming, because that one as well, there's no evidence of it anywhere except the plaintiff's claim that it existed. So this mediated settlement agreement happened, and there were events that occurred after this mediated settlement agreement. So, for example, you see after the mediated settlement agreement, Mr. Wallace Rasugu applies for permits, and permits were for two phases of work. And then the plaintiff himself begins to do work that is within the insurer's estimate, namely relocating part of his property. Those were items that were listed in the insurer's estimate. So both parties are already taking steps to implement an agreement that looks more like an agreement for both scopes of work. And this happened after the mediated settlement agreement. This was totally ignored by the court.
Well, I mean, in looking at respondent's brief on page 13, the respondent says, when asked if he had any knowledge about the scope of the agreement between Mr. Amwenga and Nugen, Pastor Mena answered, absolutely not. So if the person who's mediating the agreement cannot discuss the scope of the agreement, how did the district court err by saying the mediated settlement agreement doesn't bar the litigation, particularly when the agreement is not even in the record? that seems to be, you know, determinative in this claim that the settlement agreement sort of barred this litigation. Why? How do you? We don't have the agreement. The only evidence in the record is the person who mediated says he couldn't say what the scope of it is. So what's the evidence that this agreement bars the litigation?
The fact of the agreement itself is operative,
which is not on the record.
Yes, no, but the fact that it existed, because both parties agree,
don't know what it
the
says.
Agreement existed.
We don't know what it says, though. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, I acknowledge that we don't know what the agreement itself says, because there's a dispute between the parties as to what it says. One party says it says one thing, the other one says it doesn't. But the fact that there's an agreement in March of 2019 to implement an agreement that was made in July of 2018, that alone changes even the timelines of the agreement itself, Your Honor. Because if the agreement in July 2018 required that within 3 months this construction be done, then how can it then be implemented in 2019 of April? But my last point on this, Your Honor, there is no reason why the plaintiff could not plead and claim and prove his actual damages, Your Honor. Because in this case, there's substantial work that was already done on the property. And the plaintiff could plead and prove the actual damages to also take into account this work that was already done. I see my time is up. I will reserve time for the rebuttal.
Morning, Your Honors. Evan Livermore for Respondent James Dennis Mwenga. I'd like to start on the point about the Minnesota statute 326B.809. And as the court rightly pointed out in the exchange with appellant, this is a statute governing contractors. The obligation to provide a written contract falls upon the contractor. And there's an exchange about whether these matters need to be pursued through DLI and whether there is a remedy of sanctions. And the district court itself considered the fact that sanction would be a consequence of failure to provide a written contract. That's at the district court's findings, page 13, appellate's addendum A28. And that is a reason to find that this was an obligation on the contractor, and that the statute does not impose an obligation to provide a written agreement on the customer. The fact that the Department of Labor and Industry can sanction the contractor, not the customer, just further shows that the obligation is on the contractor, not the customer. The entire subsection from which this statute is drawn is devoted to regulation of contractors, not regulation of customers. And there's simply no authority cited by NewGen for the proposition that this is a statute aimed at resolving, clearing up disputes, that a written agreement is meant to protect both the contractor and the customer. It is clearly aimed at protecting the customer. I'd like to also talk about the mediated settlement agreement that was just discussed. As the district court correctly found, the mediated settlement agreement, to the extent we could learn about it through testimony, as you said, it was not in the record. The mediated settlement agreement did not change the scope of work. As you pointed out, Judge Connolly, Pastor Mina, the community mediator, testified he didn't know what the scope of the agreement was. So just as the district court concluded, if the mediated settlement agreement did anything, it was that the parties simply agreed to perform the work that they had already agreed to do, which is of no force and effect under Minnesota law.
Is the scope of work a real problem for the oral contract analysis that the district court undertook? Because it seems from the record it's difficult to determine that there was a meeting of the minds as to what was agreed upon, given the exterior work versus the interior work that was originally the basis for the $14,000 payment, right? So can you help me with that?
Thank you, Your Honor. And I think the district court was entirely correct and within the district court's discretion and role in determining that the scope of work under the contract was to perform the work set forth in the nationwide estimate, which was the interior work. The court considered the party's testimony and the documentary evidence. The court reached findings that in July 2018, there was a meeting between Mr. Omwenga and Wallace Rusugu, the manager of NewGen. And in that meeting, the parties orally agreed that NewGen would perform the scope of repairs set forth in the nationwide estimate, which was in evidence. The court was entitled to reach that finding based on considering the party's testimony, considering the documents, weighing the witnesses' credibility, and it reached that factual finding, and it would take clear error to disturb that factual finding on appeal. And NewGen has not offered any basis that the finding was clearly erroneous.
Isn't it undisputed that, I mean, it's these issues are very interrelated, because wasn't it Mr. Rusugu's failure to be at the job every day during the exterior construction work that led to your client essentially locking the workers out of doing the interior work, right? And so in terms of, you know, the ability, the frustration of purpose argument, the damages argument that your counterpart is making, it's hard to see, at least from where I'm sitting right now, how there isn't some error in the decision that this contract was limited to interior work, and that there must have been some separate agreement for the exterior work to be done.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think it's very unclear from the record, because the evidence showed that Mr. Omwenga objected when he saw that the workers were performing work on the exterior of his house, because it was work he didn't contract for, and it was work there was no money for in the nationwide estimate.
How long did that work go on?
I believe it was about a week, Your Honor, but...
Okay, yeah. So someone's working on the outside of your client's home for about a week. Why didn't he stop it if he hadn't agreed to it and he didn't want it to go on? What did he do to stop it?
Your Honor, he objected, and I don't know the specific day and the timeline when he objected.
You say he objected. Yeah. I object. I haven't agreed to this, and this is my property. Get off my property. I'm not paying you for this. What does the record tell us about what he did to object to work that was going on over the course of a week on the exterior of his property?
Your Honor, the record shows that he did attempt to contact Wallace, and I think eventually was in contact with him and informed him that this wasn't the work he contracted for. I don't believe the record reflects that he contacted police officers to remove them from his property. But he did object.
But isn't the whole issue that animated this oral contract, if that's what it was, is that there needed to be additional work to just what the insurance estimate identified in order to stop this problem from happening again? And that, as I understood it from the record, that work needed to happen on the exterior to prevent further water damage, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and the record did reflect that even the original contract in July 2018, the original oral contract, contemplated, because Wallace Rusugu notified Mr. Omwenga that he believed that additional work was needed to address what he called the root cause of the problems. And the district court concluded that an additional term of that original contract was that Wallace would submit a supplemental estimate to Nationwide. And then if and only if that supplemental estimate was approved by Nationwide, would that supplemental work, that exterior work, that work that Wallace said would address the root cause of the problem, only then would it become part of the contract. And the evidence was clear in the record that he did prepare a supplemental estimate that was in evidence, and the evidence was clear that the supplemental estimate was provided to Nationwide and was rejected by Nationwide.
And wasn't there testimony by the contractor that the contractor was willing to do the interior and exterior work for the price that had been allowed by the insurance company?
There was some testimony, Your Honor. It did not, the court did not find that that would happen. And frankly, Your Honor, that testimony was not credible. The Wallace Rusugu testified that he spent over $11,000 on the exterior work and claimed that he would be able to complete the interior work remaining for approximately $3,500 when it was originally estimated by Nationwide at $14,792. And the district court was entirely within its rights to discount that evidence.
There wouldn't have been no need for the separate estimate to be submitted to Nationwide if he could accomplish everything for $14,000 from the get-go, right? I mean, that was the purpose behind that exhibit that you just referred to, was to create an additional estimate to submit to Nationwide to get funds to pay for the exterior work?
Yes, Your Honor. There would have been no need for it if he could accomplish it
for
the $14,000. But the evidence showed that he did provide the supplemental estimate and that it was rejected.
How much was that supplemental estimate for?
I believe it was about $5,000, Your Honor. I'd like to also talk about the statute of frauds argument that has been raised. That argument was forfeited. It was not raised in NewGen's pretrial briefing. It was not raised at trial, and NewGen did not submit a post-trial motion. NewGen points to an argument in a summary judgment hearing, but NewGen took no other steps to preserve that, and that was insufficient to preserve the argument for appeal. In addition, in any event, this contract was not within the statute of frauds. The statute of frauds applies only to an agreement that by its terms cannot be performed or is not to be performed within 1 year. And this court has explained, that this language means whether the contract is capable of being performed within 1 year, not whether such occurrence is likely, let alone whether the work was actually performed within 1 year. And in this case, there was evidence that the contract could be performed in much less than 1 year. It was for approximately a $14,000 scope of work. NewGen has presented no evidence that anything about this contract's terms would make it not capable of performance within 1 year, and NewGen's failure to perform that work within a year, or the work under the contract, we maintain was never actually performed, but in any event, NewGen's failure to perform it within a year doesn't bring this statute, bring this contract within the statute of frauds. The frustration of purpose argument was also forfeited. This was not in NewGen's pleadings. It was not raised again in a pretrial motion. And the brief mention that during trial, during the post-trial briefing does not, that Mr. Omwenga somehow frustrated performance of the agreement by NewGen does not suffice to preserve the issue for appeal. And again, this was not proven as discussed.
I had one question. I want to make sure, based on the district court's amended findings relating to the offset. So the only defense presented at trial was there was no contract. Is that a fair statement?
There was also litigation about whether there was a contract with NewGen. NewGen hasn't really addressed that on appeal, but NewGen claimed that the contract was privately between Mr. Omwenga.
There was either no contract or the contract was not with NewGen. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, Your Honor. There was testimony from Wallace about the work he was purported to have performed and his crew performed. So there was evidence on these in the trial, but NewGen didn't plead a defense of offset, and it didn't bring any counterclaims. And our position is that NewGen would have had to make a counterclaim, say for unjust enrichment, in order to obtain any offset for the purported value of the work it did, that was outside the scope of the work Mr. Mwenga contracted for. And that was the basis of our post-trial motion, and which led to the amended findings, is that Mr. Mwenga's damages can't be offset by work that was completely outside the contract. Moreover, not only did NewGen fail to plead an unjust enrichment counterclaim, it didn't prove it either, because as just discussed, Mr. Mwenga didn't ask for this work to be done. He objected to this work being done, and he has complained about its value. So it would
complain about what?
About its value and its quality. So there would be nothing unjust about allowing Mr. Mwenga to obtain any benefit of that work.
And just so I can recall the numbers, you said the bid that was submitted to the insurance company for the exterior work was about $5,000?
Yes, Your Honor. And in connection with that offset argument.
So if we disagree that the frustration of purpose was forfeited, how is it not a frustration of purpose situation when the contractor is locked out of the interior to do the work that everyone at least seems to agree that was the agreement, or that's what the district court decided to do the interior work?
Because the frustration of purpose in order to relieve NewGen would have had to been without NewGen's fault. And even if this argument wasn't forfeited, it would have been NewGen's fault. Because there were workers on the exterior of Mr. Omega's house doing work he never contracted for, and the insurance company wasn't paying for. So he was perfectly within his rights to tell the contractors, I'm not allowing any work going forward because I don't know what you're doing. You're doing work on my property I didn't contract for, my insurance company isn't paying me for. And so putting a stop to it before anything else gets done.
May I ask one more question?
Of course.
Was the original oral agreement that it included a stipulation that Mr. Rusugu was supposed to be on site during the work that was done?
The original oral agreement, I don't think the district court's findings reflected specifically that he be on site the whole time. It was an agreement that Wallace Rusugu, as an agent of NewGen, would perform the work. I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I just want to start with that last point on the frustration of purpose. First of all, I would like to correct what Mr. Mwenga is arguing, that the work was for about a week. This work started around April of 2019. It was still being performed in April of 2020.
There were workers on site at the home that entire time? The period of time I'm asking about is like, what period of time were there people on ladders on the house performing work?
Yes, it was for about 10 days, as per the testimony that was given, but it was over time.
Explain this to me, if you would. So there's interior water damage, and NewGen says, look, if we don't fix the outside, you're just going to have interior water damage again. You've got to fix both the outside and the inside. Why can't a homeowner say, I just want the inside fixed? I don't care. I'm going to sell the house. It's not my issue.
Yes.
I mean, why is it that NewGen felt that it was its obligation to be working on the outside of the house when the homeowner said, if insurance won't pay for it, I don't want work on the outside of my house?
Yes, the homeowner is entirely within his right to say that you can only work on the inside. But that's not what happened in this case, Your Honor.
Okay, what evidence is there that the homeowner authorized NewGen to perform the improvements to the exterior of the home, absent the insurance company's agreement to pay?
Yes, and we are looking at the actions they took after the mediated settlement agreement, because the position we are taking is that at the mediation, that is exactly what they agreed. They agreed that the two phases of work could be performed for the amount that the insurer already paid. And Mr. Wallace Rusugu said he would do it on his own, because we are here as NewGen, but this whole process was being conducted by Mr. Wallace Rusugu and Mr. Mwenga on their own. And they went into a mediation where that was the very question. The very question was, well, we have this 14,792, and the contractors, not just Mr. Wallace Rusugu himself, but 8 or 9 contractors were all saying that you won't fix the problem with just the amount that the insurer has given you. You need more money. And part of the agreement, the oral agreement that the court even found in its own findings, was that they would both look for additional money from the insurer. And the process that happened between July of 2018 all the way up to April of 2020 when the work was stopped was a process where they were trying to haggle over what to do next when there was not enough money.
Okay, so there was an agreement. Here's the exterior, or here's the interior damage. Here's what my insurance company has given me to repair this interior damage. Will you do the work? And NewGen says, yes, we'll do the interior work for that price, but we need to do some exterior work as well. We'll submit an additional claim or a supplemental claim to your insurance company. And the homeowner says, that's fine, but I'm not doing the exterior work unless the insurance company pays for it. The insurance company says, we're not paying for this exterior work.
Yes.
How do we then get to the point where the exterior work nonetheless begins, even though the homeowner has said, I'm not paying for it?
No, the homeowner said he's not paying for it before they did the mediation. Because, you know, this whole case went even into conciliation court. So there was a dispute over that.
The homeowner said that before it went to mediation.
Yes.
Why doesn't NewGen then just say, okay, fine, we'll take the 14 grand and we'll repair the inside. Good luck to you going forward the next time we have ice dams or whatever caused the damage.
Yes. Mr. Wallace, and again, it's Mr. Wallace who did not do that. Because then there would be liability results if they ended up doing just the interior work and the condensation happened again. Because according to them, the root problem of this whole repair damage was the condensation problem that was
there. So then why didn't NewGen say, you know, we're not willing to just do the interior defects because we don't want to get sued when condensation causes the next problem and walk away from the job and give the money back?
Yes. That is what we were willing to do as NewGen, and that seems to be what Mr. Wallace Rasugu should have done, because we are not part of the misconduct of Mr. Wallace Rasugu.
Well, but he's acting with apparent authority, and that's not really been challenged on appeal. So NewGen is the contractor who was there. So that's what I'm not understanding. It seems like NewGen was trying to hang in there and get more out of the deal, even though the homeowner said, I'm not going to pay you to do exterior work. I mean, at that point, you just walk away from the deal.
Yeah, they could have, but when they went into mediation, because there was already a lawsuit at that point at the conciliation court, so it's not easy to just walk away when you've been sued and you're, can I answer for 2 moments, one minute? It was not easy to just say we are walking away from this whole thing because they were already in court, and this proceeding was against Mr. Wallace Asugu personally at the conciliation court. So any walk-away process would have to involve resolving that court process. And that is why they ended up in a mediation where the issues were to be resolved, including the court process. And in my brief, I do talk about the court process where they agreed that because he's in court, we are going to stop the court process, we are going to do the work.
That's why it would be a good idea for contractors working with homeowners to put things in writing before they start working.
Yes, absolutely it is a good idea. And actually that's what's required by the statute. But in this case, there was some collusion between Mr. Mwenga and Mr. Wallace Rasugu to try and avoid that whole process. And that is where it is the court should look at that whole process.
Any additional questions? No. Well, thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate the briefing and the arguments. The matter is under advisement. You'll have our decision within 90 days.
Thank you.